Today on Building Relationships with Dr. Gary Chapman, how one man overcame alcohol, addiction, and a life-threatening accident.
If you keep being their savior, Jesus never can be. There has to be a point in life when you have to trust the Lord and really turn them over to Him. And that's what my parents did to me, which ultimately led to my salvation.
Welcome to Building Relationships with Dr. Gary Chapman, author of the New York Times bestseller, The Five Love Languages. Today, author and pastor Robbie Gallaty joins us to tell his amazing story of recovery.
That's the title of our featured resource, Recovery, subtitled How an Accident, Alcohol, and Addiction Led Me to God. And this is our final summer best of broadcast, and what a conversation we had with Robbie Gallaty a few months ago. Gary, I would imagine that with as many years as you've been a pastor, you have some pretty amazing stories of God reaching in and turning people's lives around.
Well, I do, Chris, you know, and I never tire of hearing those stories and watching, you know, God transform people's lives. So I am excited about our program today as we talk with another man whom God has touched and recovered and brought back. And so this is going to be exciting.
Let me introduce our guest, Robbie Gallaty. He's the senior pastor of Long Hollow Baptist Church in Hendersonville, Tennessee. He was radically saved out of a life of drug addiction in November of 2002. In 2008, he began Replicate Ministries to equip and train men and women to be disciples who make disciples. Our featured resource is his book, Recovered, How an Accident, Alcohol, and Addiction Led Me to God. You can find out more at fivelovelanguages.com.
Well, Pastor Robbie, welcome to Building Relationships.
Thanks for having me. Excited to be here.
Now, you grew up in a very religious home. Tell us about your childhood and adolescence.
Yeah, so I actually had a really good family growing up. My parents were middle-class, hardworking parents. My dad owned a collision center. My mom worked downtown New Orleans in a oil company. We were raised Catholic, Roman Catholic, half Italian, so we were very religious Catholics. We weren't what I call creasters, you know, Christmas, Easter only Catholics. We, you know, we went every week, and I knew who the Lord was growing up, but I didn't have a relationship with Him. Like, for me, God was this overbearing, domineering kind of father who was out to chastise me every time I got out of line. I never saw God as a God of love, a God of relationship. And so I was kind of going through the motions growing up. I went to an all-boys Catholic high school, got a scholarship to play basketball. At the time, I was 6'6", 220 pounds. So I had a scholarship to go play basketball at UNC Greensboro in North Carolina. And you're probably familiar with the school. And at the last minute, the girl I was dating at the time was going to LSU, which was a school in Baton Rouge. And she's like, Robbie, there's no way you can go that far away. And, you know, in high school, you're in love, right? So I thought, I'm going to stay close to home. And I literally opened the phone book up, and I found William Carey College in Hattiesburg, Mississippi. Now, have you guys heard of that school before?
I have, yes.
Yes.
Okay, I didn't. I didn't even know the school existed. And I didn't even know who William Carey was, right? Like, I didn't know anything about him as a missionary, the father of missions. I didn't know any of that. And so I called the coach up, and I said, Coach, can I try out for the team? And this is like 2 weeks before the school starts, and so the coach is like, I don't think we have room, Robbie. You know, you're crazy. The school's about to start. And I said, well, Coach, I'm playing for a D1 school. Can I at least try out? Hesitantly, he let me try out. I brought my mom with me to that tryout, that practice. It was almost as if, and I didn't know the word providence or sovereignty, but it was like everything aligned. I was making every shot. The spirit of Michael Jordan got into me. I mean, I'm dunking the ball backward. I'm making three-pointers. My mom told me years later, she's like, son, I have to be honest. She said, prior to that day, I've never seen you play that good. And frankly, you've never played that good since that day. But on that day, right, you know, like everything worked. And the coach called me a few days later. He's like, man, we're giving you a full ride to come play basketball at William Carey. 2 weeks into the semester, the girl I left the Division I school for to go to William Carey breaks up with me. And so here I am at a Southern Baptist college, unbeknownst to me, as a Roman Catholic. And if you, for those who don't know what that means, I'm like the target of every evangelism class on campus, right? There's this game that I don't know about called Convert the Catholic. I was the deer in the headlights. But it was cool how the Lord worked that out, because I heard the gospel there for the very first time. And I heard about Christ. I knew I was a sinner. And I wouldn't come to faith in Christ in college, but I would remember that 7 years later when God would bring those seeds to fruition.
Wow. Wow. That's amazing. You see, you can look back and see God's hand working in things even before you knew him, right?
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, when you were growing up as a kid, did you have ideas of what you wanted to be when you grew up?
Yeah, you know, I wanted to, my parents were great parents. They really motivated us to work hard and really succeed in life. And so I just wanted to be successful at something. I had a really good work ethic back then. In college, here's what happened. At 19 years old, I got asked to be in a network marketing company, which is kind of like Amway or ACN or kind of a phone company we were in. And I didn't have any money, but my dad did. And my dad said, "You've got time. I'll put up the money. If you work my contacts, then, you know, we can do this business together." And by the time I was 20, my father and I had this huge network marketing business. We broke all the records in the city. I'm 20 years old, 21, I thought I would be a millionaire. So I'm like traveling the country, giving these business presentations. My mentors at the time were Tony Robbins, Zig Ziglar, Les Brown. I'm thinking, "Doc, I'm going to be a millionaire by 22, 23. I was test driving Ferraris. I'm like, this is it. And by 21, I had a downline of about 2,000 people in my downline. And what happened was the business was a pyramid scheme.
Wow.
And at 22 years old, or 21, it really was a pivotal time in my life. I got a phone call from the company after I graduated from college. I thought, this is what I'll do the rest of my life. And they said, "You're not going to get paid anymore, and no longer will the people in your downline make sure you tell them."
Wow.
And at 21, I didn't have the emotional or spiritual capacity to navigate that, because it was just overwhelming. And so I went through a season of depression. And that really started the pivot in my life where I wanted to do nothing in the business world. And that's when I started, I talk about this in my book, I started to train Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu. Now, are you guys, have y'all heard of the UFC before, like the Ultimate Fighting Championship?
Sure.
Are y'all familiar with that?
I am, yeah.
Okay. So here I am back then, 6'6", 290 pounds. I am training to be a professional fighter with a college degree, and I've got no health insurance, so that's, you know, not very smart at the time, but I'm training to be in the UFC, and I'm at a restaurant one night, and this is kind of where the life shifts. Guy comes up to me, and he's like, "Hey, man, I own a club downtown New Orleans. Would you be interested in being the head bouncer in the middle of Mardi Gras?" I said, "Let me get this straight, Gino. You're going to pay me to fight? I'm in, right?" I mean, it seemed like a great business opportunity for a 22-year-old. So I start working at the bar. You can imagine, this is a wild season of time. I realize I need a career change at the time when I'm escorting two guys to the parking lot. One guy leans under his seat, pulls out a loaded 9mm gun, points it at my head, and says, "Now tell me what to do." I thought, okay, I need a career change. And so I make a lateral move from bouncing to bartending, right? Doesn't really seem like a lot of sense now. Back then, it made perfect sense. And after I'm leaving the bar one day as a bartender, I'm coming home from work November 22nd, 1999. And, Doc, this is when my whole life shifts. And I get in a major car accident. I get rear-ended by an 18-wheeler, and my life's never the same after that accident.
How did that affect you physically, emotionally? How did you respond to that?
Yeah, so those listening can relate to this, and a lot of people start taking drugs and pharmaceutical drugs because of an accident, right? And we see this all the time in the ministry.
Yeah.
They have a shoulder injury, a back injury, a toothache. I was a 22-year-old boy, a man. I'd never taken drugs before in my life. I was an athlete, so I was, you know, always working at trying to be healthy, but I was in pain. And so the 18-wheeler rear-ended me 65 miles an hour, sandwiched my car into the guardrail. The seat broke off the hinges, my seatbelt locked, and my back torqued. Herniated 2 discs in my neck, 2 discs in my back. When I went to the doctor, they sent me home with 4 things. I was 22 years old, again, never taken drugs. 4 things, Oxycontin, Valium, Soma, and Percocet.
Wow.
And you know the story. I mean, within 3 months, I'm legitimately in pain. And so I start taking the drugs every 4 to 6 hours. And within a few months, I'm addicted to pharmaceutical drugs, right? I mean, nowadays, I read a statistic recently that said a person can have a dependency to Oxycontin in 7 days.
Mm.
7 days, you're addicted to the drug Oxycontin. And so I didn't have a chance to make it. I mean, I'm addicted to these drugs, and within a few weeks, I'm going through this 30-day prescription in 2 weeks, and so I have to find this way to fill this insatiable desire I have to get high. I can't work anymore. I can't train. I can't bartend. I just want to get high. And so people always say, you know, did you have a tendency as a child that kind of manifested years later? And what I'll say is, as a kid, I struggled with ADHD, although I wasn't diagnosed. My mom and dad knew I had it, and the doctor said you could put him on Ritalin or you can cope with it through a diet. I talk a little bit about this in the book. I went on this diet called the Feingold diet, which is basically no artificial flavors, colors, and additives. So I tell people I didn't chew bubble gum until I was like 13 years old. I mean, just never got to drink soft drinks. And my parents were able to manage that as a child. And so I had some of the tendencies for addiction as a child. But it took the accident to kind of bring those to light in my life. And so I get addicted to pharmaceutical drugs at the age of 22. And for the next 3 years, it's this downward spiral in my life.
Robbie, in the beginning of the book, you talk about one of the low points in your life. And that is when your mom calls and lets you know that you've stolen from them, I'm assuming, in order to have money to satisfy the drug deal. Talk a bit about that.
Yeah. So after I get on pharmaceutical drugs, I'm running through the medication quickly. And so so-called friend of the city comes up to me and he's like, hey, man, why are you fooling around with pharmaceutical drugs when you can buy street drugs? You can buy heroin and cocaine. You can buy it in bulk, you can bag it, sell it, and make money. And so what was a blessing for me at 19, 20, and 21 in the network marketing world became a curse for me in the drug world, because what happened is I was able to start this illegal enterprise very quickly by working my way up through drug dealers, right? I mean, a lot of guys in the drug world, they don't want to make money, they just want to get high. But I saw it as an opportunity, and so within a few months, I'm now trafficking drugs in the city. I'm selling ecstasy pills and GHB and Special K and marijuana. And I'm not saying this to anyone listening to impress you. I really just want to impress upon you just how far the Lord brought me from. Times were great in the beginning by the world standards. I mean, we had tons of money. Bought a $50,000 Cadillac CTS, black-on-black chrome rims, paid cash for it. And I say that to say, if you would have seen me back then in the midst of this drug world, you would have said at the beginning, man, you really have it all, right? Like, I mean, all by the world standards, you really have arrived. And for a season of time, you know, I did. I really believe that. But even when I would go to bed at night, I didn't know the Lord, but there was something inside of me that would say, you know, there has to be more to life than this. And for those in an addiction, they know exactly what that is. It's that there has to be more to life than this. It has to be better than where I am. And so I had money in the beginning, but like any addiction, and you guys know this, it always takes you further than you ever want to go, right?
Yeah.
I tell people it's like sin. Sin takes you further than you want to go. Sin always keeps you there longer than you want to stay. And it always charges you more than you ever want to pay, right? I mean, that's what sin does, and that's what an addiction does. It is a relentless issue in your life that never lets up. And so I ran out of money, and I didn't know what to do, but my parents were trusting and loving, close-knit Italian family. And so when my dad wasn't looking, I took his credit card and memorized the number. And my dad had a big collision center, and so he would charge thousands of dollars a month on parts for the cars. And I figured in my mind he'd never see these little charges, right? So I just charged a little bit here and there. And what I would do is I would buy stuff online, and I would pawn it or sell it for drug money. And over the course of 3 months, I charged $15,000 on my dad's credit card, almost bankrupted the family business in hindsight. My mom calls me February of that year. It's the week before Mardi Gras, and I just remember the phone call. And she says, Robbie, we found out about what you did. Your father is furious, and I'm disappointed in you. Don't you ever come to this house again.
Wow.
And I said, you know, Mom, I, in my arrogance and pride, I thought, you know, Mom, I don't need you guys. I never needed you before. I definitely don't need you now. I hung the phone up, and I took the little bit of money I had left, and I spent it on drugs, partied through Mardi Gras, and for the next 2.5 months, and I kind of document this in the book, I lived living hell on earth. I mean, I really did. It was the worst season of my life. We lived without gas in the house for 2.5 months at the end of winter, no hot air, no hot water. We mastered the art of the cold shower, where we would get into freezing cold water, get out, lather up, bear it again, and get out. And I did that. I don't even know how I did that now in hindsight, but I did that for almost 3 months because I was more interested in getting high than I was paying the bills. They turned the phone off after a month. We lived without water for a month, no electricity. And then eventually they kicked us out of the home. And I decided, after losing everything, I was going to go back to my parents and ask my unbelieving parents at the time to welcome me back in and wash away and kind of forgive the debt I had taken from them. And here's what's cool about this encounter, and I really try to capture this. God uses my two unbelieving parents to demonstrate to me the grace of God in a way I've never seen. Now, let me just back up for those listening, because this was the turning point in my life. When my mom cut me off, my mom calls me on the phone and says to me, don't ever talk to me again. Those 2.5 months, Doc, I would say, are what saved my life. And you know this. I mean, you guys have talked to people and counsel people. A perpetual addiction is always the result of an enabler. And if you're listening today, it could be you. And in my case, it wasn't my mom. Most cases, it's the mom. For me, it was my dad. But normally, it's the mom. And it's not that you're trying to hurt your children. God forbid. You want to help them. Like, you want to give them money. You want to provide for them. But in a sense, when you keep perpetuating their addiction, you're actually leading them to one of three avenues. And I talk about this, but here's the thing. A drug addiction leads to one of three outs: jail, institutions, or death. That's only three. Now, obviously, rehab and recovery, obviously, but jail, institution, or death. And by my mom cutting me off, in a sense, and saying, your father and I are done with you, don't come to this house again, they saved my life. Now, since the year 1999 till today, I have lost 15 friends in that period of time. So 20 years, I've lost 15 friends to drug and alcohol-related deaths. Six went to prison. And I'm convinced that the reason that it happened is because Mom cut me off. And here's the line I came up with, and I want to share this with you because I think this is helpful for people who are in this. If you're an enabler, listen. If you keep being their savior, Jesus never can be. What I mean is, if you keep bailing them out, why would they ever turn to God, right? Like, if you keep intervening and coming into their life and having an intervention, then why would they ever turn to Jesus? Because they have you. And so there has to be a point in life when you have to trust the Lord and really turn them over to Him. And that's what my parents did to me, which ultimately led to my salvation.
Wow. You know, when you were sharing that, my mind reflected on 3 months ago when I had the funeral for a 19-year-old who basically followed the pattern that you've just talked about. It is just, it's sad, it's tragic to see so many young lives that are lost by walking this road. Well, obviously, God brought you out of that. You were at the point now you went back to your parents, and we're going to see how they responded. How did that go?
Yeah, so I go back to the home. And I basically get on my knees, and I'm broken at this point. You know, the Lord sometimes allows us to get so low in life where we have to turn to Him. And I tell people, God's choice instrument for bringing us back to Him and getting our attention is suffering, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, suffering is, you know, nobody ever comes to the Lord when things are great and life's good. You know, normally it's when we are broken and suffering. And so there I was broken, went to my parents, asked them to take me back in, and they did. By God's grace, they welcomed me back in, took me out of the home I was in. Within a week, I was at my first rehab treatment. I went to two, but the first one, in of all places, Tijuana, Mexico. Now, that's you're going to have to read the book to figure that one out. But yeah, I go to Tijuana, and I'm there. I come back from treatment, and I do good for the next 8 or 9 months. I move cities. I talk about how, you know, one of the ways you can ensure sobriety or really increase your chances of sobriety is to relocate your life because of people, places, and things in the same city that cause you to fall. I actually relocated to a different city. I live with my sister in Alabama, and things were great, but I hurt my back again. I was trying to rehabilitate it. I hurt it again. I decided in my mind, I thought, you know what? I have a great idea. I'll go back to the same doctor that gave me the drug, but this time I'm not going to take many of them. I'll just keep them and maybe sell a few of them and just have them just in case. And you know what happens? I'm in the parking lot. I fill the prescription, and the cycle repeats itself again. And here's the thing about addiction. The reason so many people relapse and die, and this is something for people to consider, the reason with people who have a season of sobriety and then they go back to the drugs and they die, this is why. Because when you relapse and go back on drugs, you never start over. You pick up where you left off. And the body has readjusted itself at a lower level and is not able to compensate for the high amount of drugs that you're putting into your system. And so the body seizes and dies.